Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone Tires, your journey, our passion, and by Lear, a global leader in automotive seating and electrical systems.
This is Auto Line After Hours with John McElroy and Gary Vasilash, episode 336 for June 23rd of 2016. Look who's going into the Automotive Hall of Fame. Watch Autoline After Hours live at autoline.tv every Thursday at 3 p.m. Eastern Time. That's 12 p.m. Pacific. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for Autoline in iTunes, Stitcher, or YouTube. And we're here. We've got a show to do, Gary.
Yeah, two in a row. This is outstanding.
I know.
Summer's here. Two shows. It's all good.
All good. I'm going to be gone next week. I'm going to be on vacation.
We're going to have a very special show next week.
I heard. Uh-oh. All the mics?
All mic'd up. Me and three mics. So it'll be a good show. I recommend everybody watch it. Of course, I recommend people watch this show because...
Anyway, yeah, we've got Bob Gritzinger back in the studio.
I was told Scott Burgess was going to be here.
Well, you sort of look like him if you had a wig on with longer hair.
Where's Lassa? He's not Lassa.
No. This is our special guest for the show. This is Bill Chapin. This is the president of the Automotive Hall of Fame.
Indeed.
Say a few syllables so that people know that you're really here.
Right. Well, I can start with automobile. So we know that. But we are the world's Automotive Hall of Fame, located currently in Dearborn, Michigan. And we're getting ready to put on an induction ceremony on the 21st of July. And I hope we have a chance to talk about it.
We're going to talk about it. That's why you're here. But for little history of the Automotive Hall of Fame, because most people have never heard of it. I'm sorry to say this to the president of the Automotive Hall of Fame.
No, I've heard it before. So it does not come as a shock.
But it's been around a long time, way longer than
1939.
Yeah.
And I actually believe that the history that I put together, it started in a bar at the Lexington Hotel in New York in 1939.
And not under this name, is that right?
No, it was called the Automotive Old-Timers.
That's how I always knew it.
Yeah.
But it was. When did the name change?
Probably in about 1965 or something like that.
Because when I first heard about it, there were still a bunch of old-timers around, and they still referred to it as the Automotive.
Well, because the group of people that were in the bar in the Lexington Hotel in New York were there for for a big meeting and a car meeting of some kind. I was trying to think of the name. They all sort of were older, and they all got around and maybe had a cocktail or two and said, you know, we got to preserve all of this history. And so it was cooked up apparently in the bar. And so then that was in New York, and then it went to D.C. With a potential relationship with NADA, which, of course, is still there. And then it ended up going to Northwood Institute, which is now Northwood University.
In Flint.
Flint.
Uh-huh. Right.
In Midland.
Midland.
In Midland, and
which is kind of out of the way.
Well, but it was, if you may remember back then, still is today,
an automotive hotspot.
Well, but it
maybe it was back.
No, but at Northwood, they were teaching automotive courses,
right,
for really targeted towards children of sons and daughters of car dealers, and I think they still do like that.
Yeah.
So there was some interest, and it was probably an extension of NADA and DC and. Moving to Midland. And then there were a group that it was right around 1995 for the centennial of the car, you know, and they wanted to move it to Detroit. And it was late getting going, but it basically opened up in 95, 96, something like that, in right next door to the Henry Ford Museum.
So you said the old timers wanted to preserve the knowledge or the memory or what have you. So what is the nature of what the Hall of Fame does? What is its purpose?
Well, see, I've taken a slightly different task because for decades it had been about preserving automotive heritage. Well, unfortunately, my background is marketing, so I looked at that and thought, well, when you think about preserving automotive heritage, it's like looking at a whole bunch of file cabinets. Which is, in fact, what we have a great deal of. My feeling is that it's not about preserving them, but it's about telling the stories in a creative, compelling fashion that are interesting and funny and exciting to listen to. And so we do have a great resource for historical information from the basically 800 people over the years that we've either inducted or given some other kind of recognition. So great assets, but we needed to get it out of the file cabinets and digitize some of the old video footage, and which is what we're doing. So my feeling is that it really ought to be about telling and promoting the history of the industry, because they're fascinating, wonderful stories.
Mm-hmm. And we should hasten to add, you've got quite the automotive historical background to yourself, too. It was your grandfather, right?
Right.
Well, you tell the story.
Well, I have to preface it, because every time I say this story, I have my grandfather and my father who have been inducted into the Automotive Hall of Fame, and that is not the reason I got the job. I have said that on more
than... They were inducted before you came along in this position.
Exactly. And even though their names were on the wall, it was not... But my grandfather in...
Roy Chapin,
Sr., started the Hudson Motor Car Company in 1909. Detroit was a great hoppin' town for cars in those days. If you think about all of the companies that were getting started and then all of the companies that were going out of business, and the turnover and the excitement of Detroit at that period of time was really phenomenal. And Hudson stayed in business to become American Motors in 1954. My dad had worked at Hudson, who was Roy Chapin Jr., and worked at Hudson and became ultimately chairman of AMC. His core thought is that he was the one who bought Jeep from Mr. Kaiser for about 2 cents on the dollar, and was thoroughly reminded by the media in Detroit that this was Chapin's folly, and who that on the world would ever want something called a utility vehicle, and
let alone it's like a Jeep,
right? No, exactly,
some old military vehicle.
Exactly.
Why would you want that?
That's a better deal than the Louisiana Purchase.
Well, I don't know what the deal was on the Louis, but I would say yes. I would say that it was quite close. So, I grew up in the family and in a car family, and I've done it all my life, and
So you're perfect for this job, really.
Well, I'm not perfect because my board one might take question of that, but I have a great, great time doing it, and we're making a lot of strides and a lot of progress.
So who gets into the Hall of Fame? Who gets inducted, and why
and
do they
how?
Get inducted?
Well, if I can just for a second back up, there were when they started inducting people in versus just giving them a distinguished service citation or whatever, when the induction process started in the early 60s, it was, first of all, the rules were you had to be either retired or deceased. And that doesn't make for a very exciting induction ceremony.
I said to dinner to celebrate a bunch of dead people.
Right. I said to my board, having a casket on the stage is a little hard to work around and create something fun around.
An occasional posthumous induction might be okay.
Right.
If they're all...
Right.
Yeah.
But I think there was a reason for it. And I think that they just felt... In those days, if you think about it, the... executives who were being inducted into the Hall of Fame at the time really were their last years that were their most significant, because they worked down in the trenches before, and so it was really at close to the time of retirement, even into the 60s and 70s. But of course, you look at what's going on with Elon Musk and other people in the industry, that age has nothing to do with it. So about 3 years ago, we changed the rules it really becomes more qualitative rather than quantitative. And it's one of the things that I think allows us to tell better stories, allows us to have a wider range of people that we are inducting. This year's class is certainly a perfect example of that. And so it doesn't you know, we've now said you don't have to go sell a million of something or create the next great car, although we obviously have that in the mix. But it is a qualitative perspective. One of the people that we're inducting this year is a guy named Ralph Nader. Well, how do you put Ralph Nader into the same in a traditional quantitative analysis? How do you put Ralph Nader in the same sentence or category as Alan Mulally, who we are inducting? Alan obviously is a hero of the business, obviously at Ford Motor Company, but his is really what he did to save and rebuild the Ford Motor Company. Ralph Nader is a whole different story.
He obviously saved us, perhaps. We can make that argument because of the creation of NHTSA.
Well, there is certainly more to the Ralph Nader story. Hemmings broke the story on the people that we were inducting and led with the Ralph Nader story.
Of course, that's the news. Yeah. And you got to get, I mean, that must have been a long, drawn out argument. Yes. Do you for automotive people to induct Ralph Nader? That's wow. That's gutsy.
It went on for some number of hours and into a couple of different sessions. But when you think about Ralph Nader's contribution over time, I mean, you know, when Hemmings announced this story, there are now over 250, comments on this story, mostly from Corvair owners who still are obviously passionate about the subject. But when you stand back and look at it, this number of years later, think about what happened and you listen to people like Bob Lutz, who was quoted in the New York Times about, you know, I didn't really like the guy, I wasn't wild about the book, but somebody needed to come in and have that kind of an impact that he had on, and I won't say regulated, because that's not quite that extreme, but it was, but Lutz will come back and was quoted again, and as I say, the New York Times saying it was necessary. It was, it really ultimately long-term helped the industry, which I think with time and with distance, I think most everybody agrees with, except for some of the Corvair owners, and I understand that.
And for people who are watching who don't know that in 65, Nader wrote a book, Unsafe at Any Speed, and his first chapter was dedicated to the Corvair, claiming that it was a very unsafe car. And that is, it caused quite a stir at General Motors, and it probably would have gone away except for General Motors then decided that they need to investigate Ralph Nader to see, put a tail on him, I think.
Right,
and, the supermarket.
Yeah. Right. And then he found out about that, which then, of course, raised a bigger stink. And then there was a lawsuit. And the funny part is that the proceeds from the lawsuit he actually used to create his Center for the Study of Responsive Loss. So as a result, General Motors has actually funded the creation of this prosumer organization.
I have to tell you that when I went to see him about 6 weeks ago in D.C.
Was he floored? Did he think it was a prank when you guys first called?
No, because one of the people on our board is Keith Crane at Automotive News, and who is knows Ralph well, and so there was already that communication after the decision was made. But when I was sitting in the outside conference room waiting for Mr. Nader to come in, he walked in. He didn't introduce himself or say hi or Bill, it's nice to see you. He said, "You know, Chapin, have you ever thought about the fact that I went to Princeton University and then I went to Harvard Law, and neither of those institutions have ever honored me with anything?" And then he said, "Don't you think it's a little ironic? It's the auto industry and the Automotive Hall of Fame that's taking the lead on honoring me by induction." And my only reaction is, "My gosh, that's such a great idea. Can I quote you on that?" And right. He have said, "Of course." And he's obviously the man is brilliant, but he is really moved by this. I mean, this is Joan Claybrook, who was his
protege,
and I think was the first or second person to run NHTSA. Mm-hmm. She will also, she's going to be in his tribute video, and they still remain very, very close friends, and will be at the induction ceremony on July 21st. But they make, they're just a great team. And he is really a great guy. He's, in fact, he is bringing copies. He's republished the book and is okay. going to be signing copies of it at the induction ceremony.
Wow. I'd want to get one of those. That. Signed copy of Unsafe at Any Speed. Yeah. That's Indeed. One for the shelf.
Right, mm-hmm. exactly. Yeah.
So you mentioned Al Mulally. So he's going to be also inducted.
He is. And I think pretty much everybody knows that story, you know. When I think I read recently in doing my research, 90 days after he got to the Ford Motor Company, he obviously mortgaged everything and got something like a $25-26 billion line of credit. And I think people thought he was absolutely nuts.
We all did.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, right down to the blue oval.
Right.
You know, the trademark was
exactly.
Mortgaged.
If you that was probably the most controversial thing that people could understand. What do you mean the sign on the front of the building? But when you look at not only the guts that he had to recognize to do that and recognize what needed to be done, and then go fix the situation, mm-hmm. And I mean that literally and figuratively. But we all certainly here in Detroit know a great deal, and certainly more than Detroit or probably around the world, know what ultimately he did for the Ford Motor Company.
Saved him.
Yeah, I mean, right. quite the foresight.
Yeah.
Didn't need a bailout from the government. That was yeah. huge. That yeah. paid off
Indeed.
Hugely for Ford.
Indeed. Mm-hmm. So I've had people tell me that this is, you know, one of the biggest corporate turnarounds in the history of American industry, not just the car business. I don't know how you put that into context, but it's certainly, I don't feel uncomfortable mentioning that because I'm sure there are others that were in tougher shape, but it's a hard, you know, it's a hard to quantify something like that. But I think the shoe fits in that particular.
Well, I was just say one of the, then you're yeah. couching it.
Right.
What was phenomenal about Mulally is that he spent most of his career at Boeing, I mean, before he went to Ford. So, I mean, he started at Boeing in 69, and then he joined Ford in 2005. So, I mean, so that period of time, here he is running an airplane company that has low volume productions, making these giant things. And then he comes into an industry where you're making lots of small things like this.
But there's a common denominator between those two companies with Alan. When he was at Boeing, one of his first projects was the new 777 Boeing. And because of Dassault Systèmes that brought in CAD, the 777 was the first digital airplane, and it was Mulally's project. And, I mean, you can imagine from taking what the amount of time and money that they took out of that process. And, in fact, it was so important that we have, I'm sure you're familiar with the French company Dassault, but the chairman is a very close friend of Alan's who will be at the induction ceremony, and we've got him talking in Alan's tribute video about how they work together to create this CAD system for to build the first to design and produce the first airplane. So Alan was already a pioneer, and you can imagine what the resistance must have been at Boeing.
Sure.
To what do you mean you're going to do it all in a computer?
Yeah, you're going to computer fly this
will
thing.
Will it fly?
Right.
So he came, in my opinion, came to, and it ultimately was a very successful project. And so he came to Ford with a couple of clicks on his belt of being really creative and really out front. And, you know, there are a lot of people, because apparently he was overlooked, I think, twice mm-hmm. as to run Boeing. And
as CEO.
As CEO.
He ran their commercial plane division.
Right. So I think it was Ford's luck or brilliance or a whole lot of things.
Both of that, because he didn't come easily. They had to pry him out of Boeing.
He probably didn't know what the front end of a car looked like or, you know, had never been in a design studio or an engineering building.
But here's another aside. If you remember back when Ford originally did the Taurus, they did it through a process that a guy named Lou Veraldi put together called Team Taurus. And it was revolutionary at the time. They put together cross-functional teams. They benchmarked everything. Every single component on the car had to be best in class. Alan was so impressed by what Lou Veraldi did, he brought him into Boeing to talk all about that process. So it even goes back further, the connection to the Ford Motor Company. Right. And, of course, much of Boeing's workforce is UAW organized. So, again, there's a connection there. The UAW guys probably knew more about Alan Mulally than anybody at Ford did when he went to be CEO.
So he came, he obviously came with some creds, but created certainly a story that will be told for some number of generations, in my opinion.
You know, what's interesting is that he brought a cultural change to the company more than I would more than a technical change.
Yeah. Right.
You know what I mean? It's just that he created this feeling that, hey, you know, we're all in this together and let's accomplish what we need to get done.
But, I mean, we've all talked to him and been around him, his personality, and he's somebody that everybody just enjoys unless you're about to, you know, unless you've done something wrong at Ford, you know, enjoys being around and having him as their leader because he's just a really low-key, if you will, relaxed, enjoyable person to work for.
Straightforward, this seems like.
Yeah. One of the most unique people I've ever met in my life. Hey, look, we've got a couple of more inductees that we've got to talk about and a whole lot more to talk about, but let's take a quick commercial break and we'll come back to that in a minute. So, Carmen, let's give a shout out to our friends at Bridgestone. Okay, we're back. And we got to step into one of the next inductees that you've got, Bertha Benz.
Well, you talk about something not out of the textbook. But if you consider that her husband, Carl Benz, was by most counts the inventor of the automobile in 1880 or so, he was a consummate engineer, and spent most of his time working in the engineering department or the room where they were developing it. And it was his wife who said, you know, if we don't stop engineering and fiddling with this car and get it out of this garage and on the street, we're going to go broke. And she knew what she was talking about because she came from a very wealthy family and she invested in her husband's company. Now, by German law at that time, once she married the guy, she lost all of her assets and, you know, had no control or no say-so in the company. But with her say-so from a management point of view, but from an operating point of view, she was very active in promoting the vehicle. She took one of the prototypes out of the back garage and loaded the kids in it and took a drive down south about, it was probably an hour and a half or so. And women weren't even allowed to drive cars back in those days. I mean, or ride a buggy.
Isn't this the drive that Mercedes subsequently has replicated with an autonomous vehicle just in the past?
Oh, is that
right? A couple of years, yeah. What they were referring back to was her 100-kilometer tour that showed off the vehicle back then. And so they followed the same route with an autonomous Benz. So, you know, to me, there's a connection there also with Nader in that, you know, another of the inductees is sort of maybe the godmother or grandmother of what could be one of the world's safest vehicles.
Yeah. And so I think that she was never in the history books, by and large, until relatively recently. I mean, she was always a footnote as Carl Benz's wife. Right. But when you dig into the history, and Mercedes-Benz actually, or the state of Germany, created that highway that you just talked about into a national highway. It's called the Mercedes-Benz National Highway to celebrate that trip that she took.
From Mannheim to Pforzheim.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so in and of itself, I think that she ought to be recognized. But for us, which I think is particularly unique, is Carl Benz was inducted in 1984. And so this is going to be the first husband and wife team that has ever been inducted into the Hall of Fame. And I think that that just, it says a great deal about Mercedes-Benz. It says a great deal about the Benz family. And we have their great granddaughter, who is going to be on film from the Mercedes-Benz Museum, who will in Stuttgart, and we'll talk about it. And sitting in front of the original Patton Motorwagen, it will be part of our tribute video. But it's a great story, and you know, we all are working towards making the auto industry attractive for more women and being more involved, and we all know what those issues are. And in our little way, I think this is a reminder that there were some very successful, competent, smart women even back in the auto industry, and most people consider her maybe the first one in the industry. So I think it's a terrific, and Mercedes is very involved, not only the office here in the U.S., but in Germany, and they're very excited about us doing
this.
That's great.
Yeah, arguably, had it not been for her and for her foresight in investment or dowry, there may not have been a Mercedes-Benz.
Mm-hmm. I think you're absolutely right. I think you're absolutely right.
Okay, and then there's another guy that we got to get to that you're in.
Indeed, and it ties to what we're going to talk about in a minute. A wonderful man by the name of Roy Lunn, who is basically the godfather of the Ford GT40. Timing was perfect. We really wanted to do it because it's our induction is really about 3 weeks after this year's running of Le Mans. He has an incredible background besides as an engineer, besides the GT40. But when you think about how Ford, under the direction of Henry Ford II, started really with a Lola chassis and with a gussied up Ford badge on it, and I'm sorry, that's not quite the right way to say it, but it's close enough, to creating what became the Mark IV that won Le Mans. And was a 100% Ford product, and the success of it. I mean, it's the only Ford GT that's on display at the Henry Ford Museum. And Roy was really involved in both parts of that. I mean, he was the one who put for the first 2 years, of course, they never won a race. But when in 66, when they won, it was his glued together, so to speak, GT40 that, of course, made him a hero with Henry Ford II because of first, second, third, and fourth, but then went on in a year later and made the Mark II, Mark IV, the incredible success that it was.
Well, I think we got to talk about the connection to your family's company.
Yes, and I actually was at American Motors, worked there when Roy was there, and I was not working on Jeep, but he really, I would say that safely that he really helped save American Motors, because what he came in and built the first unibody four-wheel drive vehicle, which was the Jeep XJ, which became the original Jeep Cherokee and Wagoneer. Yeah. That went on for, 25 years, something like that, through AMC. Even after Chrysler bought it, they were still selling the XJ Cherokee.
And moreover, he's the guy who, if I'm right, was one of the originators of putting all-wheel drive systems into passenger cars.
Absolutely.
And using it with a viscous clutch so you didn't have to get out and lock the axles or anything like that. I knew Roy early in my career because of that very thing, of him working at American Motors. So I think he's a great addition to the Hall of Fame.
And so we're celebrating him this year because of the anniversary of the GT40. But when you dig into what he's accomplished, and he is living in Santa Barbara, is unfortunately not going to be able to make it to the induction ceremony because he's 91 years old. Mm-hmm. But his daughter is going to be there and accepting the honor on his behalf. And he's just, personally, as I say, I enjoyed working with him. And so this was a great joy for me to be able to be part of the induction process.
You know, I found when I was doing some research on him that I was not familiar with him at all. And it's like he's one of the great guys in the auto industry who made so much happen. And I would suspect so few people even are aware that there are people like this existing,
right,
who made all these great things. And we all know the big names, right? We all know the headlines. And I think that, you know, you guys recognizing people like that, I think is key.
Well, again, that's part of how we're trying to sort of broaden the class, if you will, or the people that we're inducting, because they're phenomenal stories. I mean, you know, each one of these people that we're inducting, you could write a book. People have already written a book, but they make for fascinating storytelling and videos that will be shown, at the Hall of Fame. They're great, great pieces of our auto heritage.
Before we move on to any of the other topics we want to get to yet, too, you've got some news to break here. And as they say in the real estate business, you're about to do a relo.
I guess that qualifies. I'm not sure. But, you know, the Automotive Hall of Fame has been located in Dearborn.
Next to the Henry Ford Museum.
Exactly. Next to the Henry Ford Museum. Has been since 1997. And there's always been a bit of a disconnect between what's the Hall of Fame, because they're in the same parking lot. What's the Automotive Hall of Fame and what's the Henry Ford and how are they connected? And if I go to the Henry Ford, should I go to the Hall of Fame? And so we've known that for quite a while. But what ultimately drove us to the decision that we are going to relocate from Dearborn to downtown Detroit is the impetus was Ford, of course, recently announced this incredible campus redevelopment that they're doing for all of their technology engineering on a worldwide basis. And it is going to expand significantly in the area where it is right now, but and then it's going to include the world headquarters and the Henry Ford Museum and into a great sort of global campus, and the Automotive Hall of Fame was right in the dead center of that. And I finally said, "Boy, we have a marketing problem now. Can you imagine what it's going to be like when in 5, 7, 8 years from now?" When we're, in the dead center of everything that's going on at Ford. So we will announce formally and with some detail at the induction ceremony on July 21st that we will begin a relocation search. But we think that it makes sense to take an Automotive Hall of Fame and move it downtown into the center of obviously one of the signatures stories of the of Detroit is all about, because if you look at the example I use is the Academy Awards Museum, which of course is based in L.A., is building this new museum experience for Academy Awards. Well, what other city is comparable to an industry, to a museum, like Academy Awards are to L.A.? And I think that we could offer that same kind of opportunity here in Detroit. And I think that we are working towards designing a visitor experience that will allow us to do that. But more importantly, to not just be for car people. I mean, I love car people. I am one, and we get a lot of them through the museum. But I think we can tell the story in a slightly different way so that the people who come to town and go to the DIA, who go to a variety of other phenomenal museums we have downtown, would want to come to this new location.
Have you looked at vetted anything yet? It seems like a natural for like the the Wayne State Walter Reuther Archives and the Automotive Hall of Fame, you know.
Well, so. I think the one criteria that we really want to do, if at all possible, is be somewhere along M1 rail.
Mm-hmm. So Woodward Avenue.
So it would be Woodward Avenue.
The ideal.
But also, you know, there is discussion, you know, when Joe Louis comes down, there's a complex that's going to go in there, probably expand Cobo Hall. There's going to be a hotel in there. There's a people mover stop. So it's not just M1 rail. It's the people mover as well. Because if you look at the heritage stories that are auto heritage stories along the people mover and along the M1 rail, which is one of the things we want to promote, is not just come to our museum, but get on the people mover and the M1 rail, and we will give you an app to be able to go see the Paquette plant, see where Cadillacs were first made in 1902, see where a variety of things that made Detroit the auto capital.
Where GM is now is where David Dunbar Buick got his start.
And there is a sign. There's a state marker.
I helped place that marker. So
very good. Well, I didn't. This is not a paid political announcement. For
me, I should give credit to Larry Gustin, Buick historian, but it's there.
Right.
It's
but right we there. As a group of really gearheads understand all that. We, I believe, have a big, huge story to tell for not only the auto heritage in Detroit, but and hopefully being told by the Automotive Hall of Fame, but also all the other sites and places around town.
And we'd be remiss if we didn't mention, too, there's two other inductions happening. You're nominating Matt Simoncini, the CEO of the Lear Corporation, as the industry leader of the year.
And it's not an induction. It's an award.
Oh, it's an award. Okay.
Right. And Simoncini, of course, is, you look who's carrying one of the flags for downtown Detroit right now. It's Matt. And the work that he's doing at Lear is just extraordinary. And their commitment to downtown Detroit and the buildings that they've bought and the commitments they're making to the city. So it's not only about his success with Lear, but as an industry leader of the year, but also his leadership in downtown Detroit. And then, again, you know, back to one of my old haunts, Mike Manley, who is the Distinguished Service Citation honoree this year, who is doing, in my opinion, well, in everybody's opinion, a phenomenal job running Jeep. Mm-hmm. As a quick aside, I know that when my dad bought Jeep from Kaiser, American Motors that year sold 30,000 vehicles. 30,000 vehicles. Totally. Manley is on his way this year to doing, what, 1.4 million or something like that?
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm.
So,
more than 30,000 two-door Jeep Wranglers.
Right. Easy. So the story, and certainly a big chunk of that growth has come thanks to Mike Manley's work. So he is very deserving of a brand that is just will never die.
You know, what's really fascinating to me is that you mentioned the film industry. And so here we are sitting with you, and you just said, when my dad bought Jeep. Now, it wasn't when my dad bought a Jeep. Your
bought
dad
Jeep,
bought
yeah.
the
well,
company.
Well, he didn't write, take out his checkbook and write the check.
Effectively.
But the wonderful part about this industry is that it's not these giant corporations that have no identity. Yeah. It's people. It's individuals like you who are able to say stuff like that, who are part of this. And I mean, and there are lots of stories like that, and there are lots of people who once were able to say those things that are gone, that you guys are saying, hey, let's acknowledge these people and let's preserve what they created. I mean, that's just
well. I'm slightly turning bright red, but that's okay. I agree with you 100%. These are just great stories, and I remember sitting around the dining room table talking about a Jeep. What is a Jeep? And Dad brought home a Willys, an old what was then ultimately called a Wagoneer. Yeah. And it was, you know, all of us looked out the door and said, "Really?
Yeah. You're not going to drive me to school in that?
Yeah,
are you?
Yeah, drop me off down the block.
Right. Yeah,
exactly.
Right. Yeah.
So from there, you know, everybody knows the story. But clearly, what Mike Manley is doing is extending that story way beyond where my family ever got involved. And it's wonderful.
You mentioned Keith Crane. Who are some of the other people who are making the decisions of who gets in the Hall of Fame?
Well, Keith is, we've got a number of board members who are on the awards committee. Keith is part of a board group that made the decision. It's probably for their own safety. We don't talk about who is on the awards committee.
Fair enough.
Because I'm the president of the organization, people know that I'm sort of, people give me a piece of their mind more times than not. And I think that's great. That kind of discussion about what do you mean you didn't induct and why do you, and so I'm trying to save the members of the awards committee from having to go through all of that.
You don't know anybody at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, do you? Because there are some missing elements there that right. I'd like to discuss with somebody.
Exactly. Yeah,
Warren Zevon.
Well,
you're
right. Please don't bring it up to me because I won't know what to do with the information.
Yeah.
Yeah, right.
Okay, we're going to take another quick break here. We got some other topics that we want to get into. But, Carmen, let's give a shout-out to our friends at Lear, who we were just talking about.
Lear Kinexis offers a parental controls application with geofencing that sends notifications regarding driving behavior and location, including curfew alerts, acceleration alerts, and speed alerts. All delivered to a smartphone application that includes vehicle location, driver notifications, and a report card of driving history, including notifications when predefined geographic boundaries are crossed. For more information, visit Lear.com.
Okay, we're back in the studio with Bill Chapin from the Automotive Hall of Fame and with Bob Gritzinger from Ward's Auto. But, Gary, you had on the list, and this is so appropriate, that we got to talk about the 24 Hours of Le Mans, which just ran last weekend.
Well, I mean, I think as everyone knows, that at the very last minute, literally, Porsche ended up winning the race, beating the Toyota hybrid that just failed.
Is that one of the great moments in automotive racing? I think it
one
will
of the
go
great
down.
Heartbreaking.
Yes, of course.
Yeah. I mean, I watched a lot of the race, and yeah, with 5 minutes to go, everybody in the Toyota box,
they had it locked
big
up.
Smiles on their face. Nobody was batting themselves on the back just yet because
it's not the Toyota way.
It's not the Toyota way, and they've been crushed a couple of times in the past. And it was like if the race had been 23 hours and 55 minutes, boom, they would have won it.
This right. is equivalent to the crash at Indy just, 2 years ago?
Oh, yeah, you know, yeah.
I mean, the guy had the race in the bag.
Right. Yeah. Crashed in the last turn.
So, this kind of thing was, and I just heard it peripherally because it was, Father's Day weekend. I was doing a lot of things and then heard the real breaking huge news out of Le Mans. So,
right. Yeah. One of the things, in sort of in keeping with people in this industry that are real people and have real feelings and real emotions and real respect for other people, is that, so the chairman of the executive board of Porsche, Oliver Blum, made a statement about the victory and what happened. And this is just I think, is one of the most phenomenal quotes I've ever seen from someone like that. He says, quote, "What happened at Le Mans is almost incomprehensible. From the first to the last lap, this race was competition on the ultimate level in terms of sport and technology, and it was thrilling as well. The race asked the utmost from our cars, our drivers, and the team. We are always either in the lead or in striking distance of Toyota. We are fighting until the end and never gave up. This spirit was rewarded in the end. We have the greatest respect for Toyota." Mm-hmm. I mean, isn't that remarkable that here you have the guy who wins the race saying, you know what?
Without you guys, we wouldn't have done it or something.
Because the car stalled out, I mean, they didn't even make the podium. I mean,
it was incredible. I don't know if anything official has been posted yet why the car dropped out. There was some talk that a turbocharger failed, and the car parked right on the front straight, right in front of the pits and everything. And then it made one last lap so that it could officially finish the race. And it was going to finish second, even with all this problem. But then the organizer said, no, you went around the track too slow.
And for that, we're not going to classify you.
Right.
So it was a double kick in the gut.
So they got nothing.
Not for that car.
Right.
They did end up second, but that was with another car that was even farther behind.
But that's and then talking about on the show last week, we talked a lot about how Ford would do. And
Bill, before this show, you pointed out something that I didn't know, because Ford entered four GTs that were numbers 66, 67, 68, and 69. And I watched so much of the race, hours and hours of it, until you pointed out why it was numbered that way.
Well, and it was something I learned watching the telecast also. Those were the years that Ford won Le Mans in 1966, 67. Mm-hmm. And I thought, that's just a great...
Yeah, who came up with that idea?
I would love to find out. Mm-hmm. I would really love, because I thought it was just a brilliant stroke of connecting history.
Mm-hmm. And so they took the GTE Pro class.
They took first, third, fourth. Mm-hmm. They had another car that was way farther behind. And the Corvettes, unfortunately, you know, we had Doug Fian here. They finished way behind. But to me, this was a little bit controversial, because the organizers, the ACO, like to tweak the rules to try to get everybody as equal as they can. But the way they tweaked it, the Fords and the Ferraris, the 488s, had a 4 second a lap advantage in qualifying over the GTs and the Ferraris. And I just thought, oh my God, this is just not, you know, in racing, if you have 0.4 of a second per lap advantage over the course of a race, that really adds up. Mm-hmm. So 4 seconds is an eternity. Mm-hmm. And I started to think, wait a minute, did the ACO go, wouldn't it be great to have this fight between Ford and Ferrari? So why don't we just tweak the rules a little bit? But one of our viewers sent an email and said, be a little bit careful there. There was rain during qualifying. Some were on dry, some were on wet. And looks like Corvette never got their setup right. But we got to ask Doug Fian what he thinks about it.
All right. So to that point, so let's just say, for the sake of argument, there was a little big time wrestling involved in this whole scenario here. Now you've said that viewership of racing across the board is going down.
Right.
Okay. Mightn't this not be a way to increase viewership of, you know, if other sanctioning bodies were to, I don't know, turn a blind eye?
Well, you know, turn a blind eye or write the script ahead of the race.
Right, yeah.
and you know, I think the ACO knew all along that if this was a race between Ford and Ferrari 50 years after the first Ford GT40 showed up, I mean, isn't that the perfect script? And the perfect script is, again, Ford wins it. Boy, they've got Ford hook, line, and sinker, man. These guys are going to be back to the race for the next 3 years for sure. So I don't want to, you know, belittle the effort. What Ford achieved was phenomenal. Ferrari battled them to the very end. Corvette can't win everything. So, you know, I don't want to make it sound like sour grapes in that regard. And, by the way, if you're wondering about sanctioning bodies writing a script, all you have to do is look at NASCAR's history and know that script writing is still happening. So,
mm-hmm. And, you know, the other thing that was great is that there were members of the Ford family there at Le Mans.
And Henry Ford III, right?
Well, he gets paid to be the marketing manager for Ford Performance, so... and is going to be on Roy Lund's video for his induction. But it was great to have, I don't know who all was there, but there were a number of Ford family members. And I think that's also a telling tribute to the family and the company.
Look, you know, Ford did this right. I mean, that GT4, the GT was designed all around Le Mans. It wasn't designed for Daytona and Sebring and Laguna and all the other. It was designed to win Le Mans, and they nailed it. And, you know, it almost could have been first, second, and third. Almost could have been. So hats off to them. I think they did a brilliant job. But you're right. Motor racing is losing. We're not bringing in a new generation of kids that are interested in the sport. It's going to... I don't know what's going to happen.
Do you have race car drivers in the Automotive Hall of Fame?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah.
And we, you know, it's not a specific class, but, I mean, the obvious ones, Mario Andretti and, you know, the list goes on. But because you can
write the same kind of a story that you would about the chairman of a company. I mean, certainly if you look at Mario's history, for example, the fact that his first stock car in the United States was a 54 Hudson, I'm not putting a plug in for that, but, you know.
Man, it just comes back.
Right,
back
I know.
Back.
I know. But,
never ended the Jeep story. Again. Next
I know.
Thing, you know.
He'll never, I'll never be asked back, but that's okay. This is not a, this is not
Get it
a
all out. Get it out.
Commercial.
Get it out.
No, but I mean, but you look at what Mario Andretti accomplished, with or without a Hudson, is equally as significant as some of the other chief executives of large companies.
Mm-hmm. And I got to tell you, I was there at that event where he was inducted, and you have never heard anybody so gracious, so genuinely impressed that he was being included amongst all these other luminaries of the automotive industry. Mario was one of the best inductees of any of the ceremonies I've been to see somebody say, thank you for doing this for me.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely agree.
All right, let's do a panel participation thing here with a number.
Oh, okay. Oh yes, I've
got a number.
Time for Dr.
Okay.
Data.
Okay, right. I'm ready. So, I'm writing.
No, no, no. You don't have to. No, you got to watch the screen. So look at the screen.
Okay,
Carmen, bring the first one up, please. All right, so I want you guys to identify those cars starting from left to right.
Oh, easy. Okay. It's Accord, Civic, what's the Toyota?
Toyota.
Avalon.
Is that
no, Camry?
Avalon or a Camry?
Okay. Chevy Silverado, Ford F-150.
Okay. So you got them. Okay, that was the easy part. Okay, now.
Now you're going to shuffle them.
No. So I want you guys to tell me why these five cars are significant. And I might add, these five cars are significant in that order that you just read them. So it's Accord, Civic, Camry, Silverado, F-150.
Well, one thing is they're the best-selling vehicles in the U.S.
But I said in order.
In order.
Best-selling ever.
Oh, retail.
In order.
No.
No.
Wow.
Yeah, because why is F-150 ahead of Silverado?
Yeah.
No, F-150 is after Silverado.
Or after Silverado.
Starts with Accord, ends with F-150.
Yeah.
Okay, so because you could make the argument, why is Camry behind Accord? Because Camry is always the number one selling car. F-150 is always the number one selling truck, right? But we see that the car's up there. But this is this
not
is,
fuel economy.
This is one through five. So there is a connection between the Accord and the F-150 that is not just the. So it's not truck to truck.
Destination charge?
All right.
You got me stumped.
All right.
This is the first time I've ever been on this show, so I mean, I'm supposed to not know the answer.
No, anybody can know the answer to this. Okay, so the answer is those are the top five most stolen vehicles in the United States.
Oh,
in
this
that order.
Thing.
In
no,
that
now,
order.
Wait a minute now, and this is always a skewed number.
And this is according to NHTSA, which brings us back to Ralph Nader. So
do they compensate though for the numbers? You know, for the population.
No,
that's what always bugs me about this is per capita, because if you sell more Camrys,
Camry
ought to be number one.
Should be number one.
Exactly. So this is why.
Right.
Just keep going. All right. So basically,
they have better locks on the F-150.
No. I don't have the answer to why this is the case. So how much money is that cost? The third one, Carmen, please.
Over $4 billion.
Over $4 billion.
Okay.
Wow. So this is a little preemptive because there won't be a show on July 7th, which is the first Thursday in July. Mm-hmm. But so just as a warning that according to NHTSA, that July is Vehicle Prevention Month. So keep your vehicle safe.
Vehicle prevention?
It's either that or get rid of your Accord, Camry, Silverado.
Maybe get one of those, what do they call those things? The club.
The club, yeah, right, yeah.
Yeah, whatever happened to them? They were all over TV ads way back.
Well, people still have them.
Probably these figured out
live,
how
right?
to
Depends
Gary
where
Riggum,
live,
so
yeah.
they. But I think it's. How did you, just out of curiosity, gather that piece of data? I mean, first of all, how did that idea come into your head?
Because I think it's. I got to come up with something every week. So
do you?
I'm looking for numbers and so on. NHTSA had this, and so I thought that was.
The press releases just flow right into Gary, and he turns it into a data point.
So, All right, what else are we going to talk about since we've now gone to thievery?
Well, yesterday, Volkswagen at the shareholder meeting said, we're going to build 30 electric cars. We're going to bring out 30 electric car models, and we're going to sell between 2 to 3 million every year by 2025. And it's going to represent 20 to 25% of all of our sales. And, oh, by the way, the entire market by 2025, 9 years away, will be about 25% electric vehicles. And I talked to some powertrain people last night, and they were like, what are they talking about?
Well, they didn't want to announce coming out with 30 diesel vehicles, so there's that.
Right. There is that. But what do you guys make of it? And are EVs... I do believe EVs are going to catch on more strongly.
Oh, sure, yeah.
But to go from where they are right now to one quarter of, I mean, they're like, what, 1% of the market globally right now, 1%. In 9 years' time, can they go to 25%?
I don't know if the grid is there to handle it. I spent a long time talking with an engineer from Volvo at the S90 drive just a week ago, and one of the things that he was pointing out is, you know, the power demand needed just to recharge vehicles, say, along the freeway at a typical fueling station, you know, you would need a substation at every one of these recharging stations. And that's not there. And the ability to do that isn't there yet. So that's just a really basic thing that needs to be sorted out before you can get to having a large population of battery electric vehicles only. You know, hybrids, yes, or, you know, Volt.
Did they say electric or electrified?
Pure electric is what he said.
Because that was my question, too, Gary. Yeah. I thought, okay, if they're talking about electrification, plug-ins, plug-in hybrids, pure battery...
Hydrogen,
but, you know, I think mild hybrids, you know, the 48-volt hybrids, I think are going to become very widespread.
And the plug-in works because you have people charging at all different kinds of locations. Mm-hmm. But to just count on battery alone and recharging stations, that's a trick that... You know, to get to 25%.
I looked at it sort of, not from a technical point of view, but when you think about the number of diesels they sell in Europe and the what I believe is that people in Europe buy those diesels because they're fun to drive. And what is going to give the same Volkswagen customer 20 years from now, assuming that diesels may not be, may not have the shelf life that they had once had, what choices did Volkswagen have to replace that fleet, those models, with something that will be more interesting and more fun for consumers to drive? I think it is, you know, the electrification and the variations of that, might have been one of the only answers. I don't know.
Well, electric sure is fun.
It is.
To drive.
Yeah. Oh, look,
that's
I love it. Yeah, right.
Lot of zip.
But, you know, when I look at what's going on everywhere in the world right now, electrics have not caught on. Guess what? Hybrids really have not caught on. Mm-hmm. The Prius sells in good numbers. Right. Its sales are down substantially, but it's still in good numbers. But, boy, I was talking to powertrain people.
Okay, but isn't it possible that this is actually the silver lining to what happened to Volkswagen? I mean, and we don't even know how that's all going to play itself out. But, I mean, here you have one of the major companies in the world who's saying, okay, we're gonna place a giant bet on this. We're gonna transform our company. We're gonna do something. I mean, if we were able to come from, you know, literally the rubble and become as an important company as we became, and we take that same sort of energy and effort and investment and make it in electric vehicles, so how can other companies not do that? Okay, how can they say, nah, we're
going to let them go it alone.
We're going to let them get it all, and if they're right, then we all lose. So what may end up happening is the fact that this may, you know, just start the flywheel turning.
Be the impetus to launch an electric revolution.
And it makes sense that they are the first out of the chute with that kind of volume projection. I mean, with that, because they got to come up with some solution,
right?
Because I
you know, how secure is the future of the diesel engine in Europe, for example? Probably not a whole lot.
You know, and I got to believe that the executives at VW are probably very, very skittish about saying anything about anything. And for them to come out with such a bold proclamation, I mean, you got to believe that, you know, it was more difficult for them to make, that decision than for these guys to decide on Ralph Nader. I mean,
yeah. Oh, yeah.
I wouldn't go that far. Yeah. Thank you for the thought. But
Well, it's a big bet. I wish them the best. But, man, that's a lot of shareholder capital that they're putting to risk.
Mm-hmm. Well, then we so there's the electric vehicle symposium is going on right now in Montreal, and so what was it yesterday that BMW announced that they're going to begin to repurpose the batteries from i3s. Once you're done with your i3 battery, you stick it in your garage and you have yourself a power source that can be used to run your refrigerator as well as to charge your car. Mm-hmm. And we've seen that General Motors has been talking about doing that with Volt batteries.
Nissan with the Leaf batteries.
The Leaf batteries.
Everybody's jumping in the pool.
So suddenly what you have is a situation whereby you're not just looking at companies saying, hey, we're a car company that builds cars. We're a car company that maybe
does energy.
Yeah, right, and provides services and does things like this. And, you know, when I was thinking about all these diesel engines, remember the other thing that the Daily Can ban had broken was the battery swapping station? Was it being run by a diesel generator?
No, yes. Yeah. that's exactly right. Well, hey, guys, we ought to wrap this up here. But Bill Chapin, thanks so much for coming in. Fascinating what you're doing
at
the AHOF. And congratulations on your upcoming move.
Thank you very much.
And yeah, keep us posted on that. That'll be news.
We don't have it buttoned up yet, so it's going to be a couple of 3 years. But I'm as soon as we get through the induction, I'm headed it right into that as the next project.
Mm-hmm. You're going to have a lot of Ford employees probably just in the meantime sort of squatting in your area. I hear that's what they do.
Well,
now in the new campus environment. They just kind of show up at
and
your
desk
and
we'll serve
work
them coffee and give them a Danish if that's necessary.
And teach them a little automotive history.
Exactly.
They might need it.
Exactly.
Bob Gritzinger, great having you back here.
Great to be here, Jan.
And Gary, you run the show all next week.
Okay, so we'll do.
Mic it up.
Man, mic it up.
Real good. So thanks, everybody, for having tuned in.
AutoLine After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone Tires, your journey, our passion. And by Lear, a global leader in automotive seating and electrical systems.
Visit our website, AutoLine.tv, where you can watch us live Thursday afternoons. Get your daily fix with AutoLine Daily and in-depth analysis and interviews with AutoLine This Week. There's all that and much more at AutoLine.tv.